Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Chapter 10. The performance went well. Now Gabriel can taste the garlic from dinner. His lungs ache from the icy air as he walks quickly to his car. He feels slightly ill. While the car warms up, he rests his head on the steering wheel and swears softly to himself. He was happy to be dancing again, but it felt strange. Closing night, he joined the others, of course, and there was too much champagne, the Italian food heavy with cheese, and the news about his old friends and is making his head ache. Jerry, Antoine, Margaret, Tony in New York, AIDS, gone, dead. He can see them, their healthy bodies, the flush of their skin, the sound of their laughter as it echoed in the big dance studio. He feels their absence in the stillness, in the cold. Someone taps on his windshield, concerned. Gabriel smiles to show he's okay and waves the man on. He watches the man walk down the street, huddled up against the cold in a bulky fur coat like a bear in black boots, until he disappears around the corner of the Hudson Bay Company. Gabriel slips Gould's final Goldberg variations into the tape player and heads north with his ghosts. He drives on automatic pilot, trying to ignore his nausea, but he is sweating by the time he gets out of town. He has to keep driving. The road is rough, his tires need air, and the constant vibration is turning his brain to mercury, heavy, smooth, and too susceptible. No one could tell him about Greta. They had heard nothing of her, but no one said she was dead, like the others. The light is on at Dave's service station. Gabriel pulls in, parks to the side of the garage, and walks carefully inside. Sees no one, and sits down on an orange plastic chair. He calls out, "Dave," realizing he sounds like a sick wolf as soon as he hears his own voice howl out the name. Dave comes in through the inside garage door, wiping the grease from his hands on a plaid flannel rag. "Just finished." "You're sick, Gabe," Dave says, walking over to him. He leans down for a better look, looking directly in Gabriel's pale face. Gabriel is too ill and tired to lift his head. "Right," he says. "Can't dive. Drive. Champagne." On his way home, Dave drops Gabriel off at his house and sees him safely inside. He can ride down to the station with him tomorrow to pick up his car. Dave drives along the dark road with the satisfaction that they're more or less even now, and he can forget about the time he was such a drunken fool after he and Tia broke up. Gabriel is a good man, not too bright sometimes, and a little odd, but a good man, he tells himself, rather pleased at Gabriel's overindulgence, though he hopes he's not getting in with a bad crowd down in Winnipeg. This would never have happened before. He never drank before, or maybe just a little wine once or twice a year. But when Gabriel was sick and he had to stop the car and they saw those deer, Gabriel cried out, "Antoine," and reached out toward the deer like it was a personal friend, not bothered him. "And who's Greta?" He kept asking where she was. He kept saying, "Greta." He'd better ask tomorrow. Or maybe not. It's just after midnight when Dave pulls into his driveway, relieved to be home these nights with all the deer on the roads. After closing the garage door, he hears an owl in the woods. He stands and listens to its long, slow hoots before he goes inside. That'll be one to start on, a good one to record with his new microphone. Maybe tomorrow night. Dave grabs his notebook, goes straight up the stairs, and climbs out the window to check the sky. He checks the time, makes his notations, props his new birch pole marker, and climbs back inside. Despite the grease, he decides to shower in the morning. He doesn't mind the grease. He can smell it all over him. Even his hair feels clumpy with grease. But he's too hungry to wait for breakfast, so he opens a beer, slices a couple of big wedges of Jarlsberg, saws off two pieces of rye from the round loaf he picked up at Tia's store. He slathers on mustard and eats at the counter like a hungry giant, taking big, tearing bites. Putting away the cheese, he looks at the salami, thinks about taking a big bite, but slams the refrigerator door instead. He just might go on that moonwalk next Monday. Tia says they usually have about 7 people or so. He pulls the crumpled paper out of his shirt pocket. Join us. Enjoy the full moon on our monthly walk around Loon Lake. Meet at the Northern Natural Food Store at 7:45 p.m. for hot cider. We'll leave for Loon Lake at 8 p.m. He leaves the notice by the phone so he won't lose the details. Tia didn't seem to think it was odd that he was interested. When she was talking to her friend, Snowbird, they both acted like it was perfectly natural he'd want to come. Dave goes to bed feeling hopeful, tired, and smelling like the engine of a car. The next morning, Gabriel wakes to the sun in his eyes. He shifts to his side, amazed at how good he feels. No headache, nothing. He had a dream about Greta, but he can't remember what it was about. But he feels terrific. He lets himself wake slowly and looks at the snow crystals in the lower panes of the window. Each one different, each perfect. How he misses his icy windows. How he missed his icy windows when he lived in Paris. He gets up, stretches in a sheath of sun, and looks out over his orchard down below in the snow. Trying to remember his dream, he catches a glimpse, sees Greta stretching at the bar before class with the sun shining across her hair. He can't remember more. Out his bedroom window, a few sienna-colored apples still hang in the treetops, waiting for the crows and squirrels. Next spring, he'll dance in the orchard. He says her name to himself, Greta. He's squeezing the last few drops of juice out of a pink grapefruit directly into his mouth when the phone rings. It's Dave, who says he'll pick him up so he can get his car at the station. He tells Dave he's sorry he had to go down just for that, but Dave says he's taking down a part for a van he has to finish up, and that's why he was working so late last night. He towed a van full of rock musicians out of the ditch down by Half Crow Creek. He was working on the clutch last night and had the one part in his garage at home, so he'll finish up this morning. They need it by noon. Gabriel is glad David doesn't mention his condition last night. On the way to the service station, Dave counts hawks. 7, he says. Another on the fence post. How the hell do they photograph something like that? If you stop the car, it flies away. So even if you have a zoom lens, it's flying by the time you're ready. I suppose you have to sit there and wait, Gabriel suggests. Like for ducks. Build yourself a sort of blind. Funny how you see so much more once you start looking, Dave says. Like those red dogwoods along here, against the snow. Who'd believe anything could be naturally that red? Of course it's only red in winter, turns dark in summer. I wonder why. Indians use dogwood for toothbrushes. Try breaking off a branch sometime. Keep twisting until it comes off, back and forth. You'll see why they use it. Yeah, try it when you're out camping down the lake. Have you ever been up to Churchill, Gabriel asks, to see the bears, take pictures? Funny, every now and then I think about going up there, but I've never been. I could have gone as a kid, but I had measles or something, so I missed out. I think I'd rather see a black bear. You'd have to be careful taking a picture of a bear, Dave says. I guess, Gabriel laughs. They can run like the wind. I can record them now, too. Those hippie kids gave me a microphone so I wouldn't call the police. Plus, I made them pay me in cash, the balance due today, when they come to pick it up. Bobby, the one with the blue hair, showed me how to use it. He had a suitcase full of adapters and stuff, fixed it up to my radio tape player out in the garage. It records. I hadn't even known that. He had me hold out the microphone to the back of that old Ford out there that needs a muffler, and it recorded just like it sounds. Here we are. The guy with blue hair is waiting in a black pickup when they pull in. He has a neon blue mohawk and an earring that looks like a screw in one ear. He pulls on a black beret when he gets out of the cab and looks almost normal. He's wearing an expensive wool top coat and has high black mucklucks with leather toppings. Bobby, this here's Gabriel. Dave makes the introduction. Dave is surprised that Bobby knows Gabriel's last name. Bobby tells Gabriel they all saw him, he and his band and the Nutcracker, and that he is a great artist. As Gabriel walks toward his car, he hears Dave asking Bobby how to record the great horned owl in the woods by his house. Gabriel drives to his studio. He picks up his mail and the newest batch of notes slipped under his door. His old films are ready. He can pick them up any weekday morning at the Northern Goose Photoshop. There are clips of rehearsals, some quite old from when he was still a kid, some from school, summer workshops, and later shots from his professional years, Winnipeg, New York, Copenhagen, Tokyo, Paris. His friend Juliet had done a montage as a professional project when she was still at the Sorbonne. He found it last fall when he was cleaning the basement, but it was on 16mm, and he had no equipment to watch it. Now he'll be able to see it on DVD. He can't even remember all of what's on it. Maybe Greta? Gabriel strips down to his tights and t-shirt and puts on his ballet slippers. Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun or The Firebird. Firebird, he decides. Debussy would make him too sad. He's melancholy enough. Friends far away, dead friends, lost friends. He feels as he did with the migraines, but without the physical pain. He sits in the center of the studio and closes his eyes, trying to center himself so he can dance. Perhaps dance himself back into some light. How has he come so far since morning? Jennifer opens the heavy old door to Gabriel's studio as quietly as she can, which is difficult. She has to hold it with all her strength to keep it from slamming in the updraft. She eases it closed, brushes the snow off her shoulders, takes off her hat and gloves. She can hear the Firebird from the studio above, but he's not dancing. She waits for a loud section, then hurries up to the first landing and slides onto the windowsill next to the radiator. She loves this wild music, forgets that she only stopped for a moment of spying. She runs up the stairs and knocks on the studio door. Oh, Mr. Perez, I don't know why I'm here. Well, yes, I do. I had to see you. Have you been crying? No, but your eyes are just red. I'm always crying. It's my artistic nature. That's what Richard says. He's a senior. He's Rogers in the play, the butler. Will you come see it? She asks. I'd like to. 10 Little Indians, yes, by Agatha Christie. I remember some controversy about the name. Good that they changed it. Are you in it, too? I am. I'm the cook, Mrs. Ethel Rogers. It's a week from yesterday. Opens Friday night, the 21st. You can come Friday night, Saturday night, or there's a matinee on Sunday. I like this music. It's so dramatic. Stravinsky's Firebird, Gabriel says. The Rite of Spring guy, I know. Well, I have rehearsal now. I'm off. Let me know when you can come. I'll get you a ticket. I am so happy, Mr. Perez, she says, backing down the stairs. She throws Gabriel a kiss and puts on her hat. At his studio window, he watches Jennifer run down the street till her pale blue parka and bouncing white hat disappear into the snow. Greta had a white hat, furry like that, like a cat or a rabbit, and soft. What if that had been Greta the other day when he was in Winnipeg? He had walked along the street toward his car, spotted a woman who looked like Greta. Partly it was the way she walked, so light on her feet, even in winter paraphernalia, that made him dash across the street. He was sure it was Greta, or that it might be. He was excited, rushing along the street to catch up. But no, it was a pinch-faced woman with a scowl who clutched her purse to her chest when he caught up to her. She snorted at him and took off in a huff, her nose high in the air. Gabriel had felt empty as he watched her walk away. Now he takes his time peeling an orange while stretching his right leg at a 90-degree angle against the smooth metal of the wood-burning stove. He switches legs while he eats the orange segments. All this mail, every day more mail, invitations, congratulations, long handwritten letters from students who want to study with him, some enclosing photos, today one with a DVD, letters from dance teachers who want to work with him, upcoming summer workshops, all the old possibilities. He sets aside the mail and plugs in his camera, which has needed recharging for months. He's filmed his students very few times in the last 5 years. They are uncomfortable watching themselves and become clumsy as soon as he gets out the camera. If they know ahead of time that he's filming, half the class doesn't show up. The last time, which must have been late summer, Jennifer sat sobbing to herself in the back of the room. They're too emotional or too young. Maybe he hasn't gone about it right, but lately he's been using it for himself, finds it a helpful tool. One simply has to be objective and not take one's physical self too personally. He can't remember a time when he wasn't objective about himself. He always observed himself. Back when he was very young, before he had even learned to speak, he recalls watching a butterfly in his backyard, flying from flower to flower, landed on his arm. He watched the butterfly what seemed to be a very long time, and that image has always stayed with him. He has a sense that he is something like that butterfly, something small and fluttery that exists whether you can see it or not. He's never taken his body personally, has never blamed it for the migraines, doesn't give it all the credit for his physical pleasures, as a dancer or otherwise. His past lovers, how good. Funny how only recently he's realized how much they all resembled Greta, especially Juliet, whose eyes were as dark and brown as coffee beans. Greta's eyes were larger, though, and they both liked poetry. He had listened to Juliet read poetry in the bath, her beloved Mallarmé or Rimbaud, and he was sure she read whether he was there to listen or not. She would slip underwater mid-sentence, and the poetry and Juliet would appear to drown, and then bubble up moments later as a happy, rippling laugh, and she would abruptly finish the poem in great seriousness. He sees her name in the credits of French movies now and then, as art director, montage editor. Greta liked to recite poetry, too, but she would do it from memory. She said she used to read poetry when she was little, when she was lonely, and she just seemed to remember the poem she liked. And she used to write little poems, sometimes making them up as they walked along the river, short little poems about the birds, or the sky, or the rain falling on the treetops. He wishes he could remember the one about the rain. They were like haiku, those short little poems she'd make up on the spot. She had a musical speaking voice, and she spoke slowly because she liked the sound of the words. Rain. He can just hear her say the word. Rain falling down. And he might find her again. He might. Anything is possible now that he's dancing again. What to do, what to do? He chews at the thick white pulp of the orange rind. Does he need to do anything? He's sure it would be easier if it were summer. It seems hard to think, with all the ice and snow. If he could get to Apollo Bay, but couldn't he? He could snowshoe or hire a dog team. Dave will know someone with huskies. He's sure. He'll check after his acupuncture this afternoon. Part 2, Chapter 11. Gabriel slows down as he nears the station, then speeds up again, since it's obvious Dave has finished for the day and closed the garage. He is more determined to take a trip down the lake since the acupuncture session. He told Dr. Saunier about his lake idea, although he didn't tell him about the spiritual migraines. Paul gave him a packet of loose green tea as a gift, told him to call him at his office if he goes or leaves a message with Trina as to where and when he'll leave so he can chant and meditate for him. When Gabriel looked at him with concern at his comment, Paul simply laughed and patted Gabriel on the arm and told him, It's fine. It's all part of it. We all have to live our own puzzles, don't we? Gabriel seen Lake Superior's shore in late fall, cracked into great puzzle pieces of ice floating on the dark water and sloshing about like stranded ships. He's felt the winter winds across the lake with a force a grown man has to brace hard against and cold enough to make you forget your destination. He thinks of the steam he saw rising above the water last year before the freeze, and the layer upon layer of gray, land, steam, sky, all one, then the dazzling winter light of December on the white land. But he's only seen it from shore. He's never walked out into it, into all that white. Gabriel knocks on Dave's door, and nearby birds fly off to the woods. No answer, and the door is locked. He goes around to the side, which is usually open. He steps inside and is startled by the unusually strong smell of burnt wood. One gray sock and a wood-burning tool hang from the clothesline strung above the wood-burning stove. The kitchen table is covered with newspapers, and Gabriel smiles at Dave's newly made wooden sign. Dave Duckett's Satellite Tracking Station. He's used the wood-burning tool to form the words, plus a constellation of the Big Dipper in the corner of the sign. He looks for some paper so he can write Dave a note. On the back of the moonwalk notice, by the phone, he writes, Dave, I've gone to Apollo Bay. I'll be fine, and we'll call when I get back. Nice sign, Gabriel. That settles it. The note makes it final. He drives home, calls Pearl, his accompanist. He leaves her a short voicemail message to let his students know he's canceling classes for the remainder of the month and that classes will resume again in February. He remembers to ask her to tell Jennifer that he'll try to make it to the play if he gets back in time. Next, he gets out the Winnipeg Yellow Pages and puzzles over how to look for dog teams. He calls an outdoor sporting goods store, and they call someone from the back of the store who knows someone. Takes down a number for a man by the name of Buckshot Johnson. Gabriel considers the name, pauses, then dials with determination. Ghost Barns. Dave loves the sound of the wind blowing through the empty barns in the countryside. He and Bobby with the blue mohawk are in the middle of a barn, adjusting the sound on the recording equipment. This is their second barn of the day. The first was an old wooden barn, and now this one is stone, a thick stone barn built by a Scottish stonemason who built a number of stone houses in the region some years back. All excellent stone houses, built to keep out the cold and to last many generations, with 15-inch thick windowsills, same as this barn, which is temporarily out of use. For Dave, it's a ghost barn. He likes to visit the empty barns to listen to the wind, and now, with Bobby's help, he's recording the winter winds as they howl through the barns. They're getting a deep-toned cave-like sound from the stone barn. The first barn, an old wooden barn, had a more whistling sound. They've also recorded flapping pigeon wings up in the rafters and the cry of a scrawny cat, which Bobby plans to take home if they can catch it. They almost caught it when they first arrived. In the wooden barn, they recorded a shutter knocking back and forth in the wind, a creaking haymow door, and now they're both startled. What luck, a cooing morning dove. After they've recorded the morning dove, Bobby tells Dave to talk into the microphone and say, end of ghost barn number 2. Give the time and date, and tell a few details about the barn's history, appearance, and location. Dave is enjoying this.
You've been listening to episode 6 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings, if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband Robert Ellis on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we'll be hearing Improvisation by Francis Poulenc, and Moon by Peter Sculthorpe.